Coming up on the show today, Israel has agreed to humanitarian corridors and pauses.
The first such corridor open between 4 and 5 hours every day for the past few days has already enabled many thousands of people to reach safer areas. The second route along the coastal road will enable many more thousands to reach safer areas in the south.
Plus, is the war in Ukraine a stalemate?
If we talk about Kherson region, it looks like Ukrainian forces managed to cross the river of Dnipro.
And later, a look at the logistical challenges of getting aid into Gaza and a conversation about rising global temperatures. Today is Friday, November 10th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Thousands of Palestinians streamed onto Gaza's only highway on Friday, fleeing the combat zone in the north. This after Israel announced a window for safe passage. Amid an intensifying campaign of airstrikes and ground battles, the search for safety in Gaza has grown increasingly desperate. Tens of thousands have walked south, where they still face the prospect of ongoing bombardment and dire conditions. Others have crowded into and around hospitals, sleeping in operating rooms and wards. Israel maintains, though, that Hamas is using the hospitals, schools, and mosques as bases. The AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
Israeli strikes have hit near several hospitals in Gaza City as the military pushes deeper into dense urban neighborhoods in its battle with Hamas militants. Israel has accused Hamas fighters of hiding in hospitals and using one, the Shifa Hospital complex, as its main command center. The militant group and hospital staff deny the claim, saying Israel is creating a pretext to strike it. The head of the Hamas-run media office in Gaza says Israel struck the Shifa courtyard and the obstetrics department, as well as two other hospitals early on Friday. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Elsewhere, in France, far-right leader Marine Le Pen has sparked much criticism over her plans to attend a weekend march to protest rising anti-Semitism in France. Her own party, however, has failed to shake off its anti-Semitic heritage. The party's founder, Jean-Marie Le Pen, her father, was convicted repeatedly of anti-Semitic hate speech and played down the scope of the Holocaust. French Prime Minister Elizabeth Borne, numerous political parties and citizens are to attend the Sunday march. Le Pen has said that she and her National Rally Party will also be there in what some see as an attempt to leverage the Israel-Hamas war to make herself more palatable to mainstream voters. Meanwhile, in the United States, bipartisan support for Israel remains strong. The announcement of humanitarian corridors and pauses in the fighting, though, comes amid increasing outrage about the mounting number of civilian casualties, including from some Democratic members of Congress. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has that story.
As thousands of Palestinians fled the fighting and Israel's bombing, U.S. President Joe Biden was asked whether there was any chance of a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, and he replied, none. He was also asked if he's getting frustrated with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for not listening to U.S. requests.
It's taking a little longer than I hoped.
At the State Department daily briefing Thursday, Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel provided some details about Israel's announcement that it has agreed to 4-hour daily humanitarian pauses in the fighting in northern Gaza.
There will be two humanitarian corridors allowing people to flee the areas of hostilities in the northern part of Gaza. The first such corridor open between 4 and 5 hours every day for the past few days has already enabled many thousands of people to reach safer areas. The second route along the coastal road will enable many more thousands to reach safer areas in the south.
On Capitol Hill Wednesday, anti-Israeli government protesters showed up to a hearing where most Democratic and Republican lawmakers expressed their strong support for Israel. But some Democrats were troubled by the large number of civilians killed in Gaza. Democratic member Joaquin Castro said Israel has fired more than 20,000 bombs on Gaza and only about 5 hostages have been released.
It seems to me that Prime Minister Netanyahu is prioritizing collective punishment over the release of hostages. And I'm very concerned about that.
Another Democrat was concerned that new House Speaker Mike Johnson might be playing politics with U.S. military funding for Israel. Representative Gregory Meeks, a Democrat.
Speaker Johnson brought an Israel-only supplemental to the floor. This supplemental is unprecedented. It conditions aid to Israel on domestic policy objective and stands no chance of passing through the United States Senate.
The Republican chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Michael McCaul, said he agrees.
And let me just say, I too agree. We need to move swiftly on a national security aid package that both addresses the threat from Russia to Ukraine and Europe, the threat from communist China to Taiwan and the Pacific, the threat from the Ayatollah in Iran to Israel by its proxies and the southwest border.
The Democratic majority Senate will not take up the $14.3 billion bill providing funding for Israel's air and missile defense systems passed by the Republican majority House of Representatives last week. Democrats objected to Republicans paying for the aid to Israel by making cuts to the budget of the Internal Revenue Service, the agency responsible for taxation. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
As Israeli troops move into the center of Gaza City, there are growing questions about what will happen to the Palestinian territory after the war between Israel and Hamas militants is over. As Henry Ridgewell reports, Washington has made it clear it would not support any Israeli reoccupation of Gaza 18 years after Israel withdrew its forces and settlers.
What happens to Gaza after the Israel-Hamas war is finished? Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told ABC News this week that Israel will, for an indefinite period, have security responsibility for the territory. Following a 2-day meeting of foreign ministers from the Group of Seven leading industrial democracies in Tokyo, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Wednesday Hamas must be defeated, but also gave a message to Israel.
It's also clear that Israel cannot occupy Gaza. Now, the reality is that there may be a need for some transition period at the end of the conflict, but it is imperative that the Palestinian people be central to governance in Gaza and in the West Bank as well, and that, again, we don't see a reoccupation.
Israel and its Western backers must have a plan for post-conflict Gaza, says analyst Yossi Meckelberg.
What happens if Hamas disappears as a political and military power? Who is sucked into this vacuum? It might be even worse than Hamas. I think we move into an interim period, and I think there is important. I really think should be a regional element to this.
U.S.-Israeli ties remain strong, but there are disagreements, says Meckelberg.
They don't trust Netanyahu. They don't trust the current government. And they know that, you know, giving too much of a blank check can be dangerous.
In only the second joint statement from the group since the October 7th attack, G7 foreign ministers condemned Hamas and demanded the release of hostages and called for pauses in the conflict to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza. Japanese Foreign Minister Yoko Kamikawa said she believes it's important that the G7 was able to put out its first unified message as a written statement regarding the agreement on humanitarian pauses in Gaza. The G7 did not call for a more permanent ceasefire. Across the world, there have been protests calling for an end to the war. There is a danger that the conflict exacerbates global divisions, according to Meckelberg.
It's very tricky because the G7 obviously represent the kind of the more affluent part of the world and the one that's much of the resentment is directed at of neglecting and taking an approach which protects their interests but not the rest of the world interest. And I think, you see, I for one find it difficult to feel sorry for their predicament, because the neglect of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was criminal.
Meanwhile, the G7 reiterated its support for Ukraine as it continues to fight Russia's invasion. The group also condemned North Korea's missile tests and arms transfers to Moscow. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
Aid convoys have been making their way into Gaza daily since October 21st, when Israel began allowing relief to be delivered. The trucks must take a detour, however, because Israel insists on inspecting the loads before they reach Gaza. VOA's Natasha Mozgovoya reports from the Nitzana border crossing between Israel and Egypt.
Over 700 trucks from Egypt loaded with water, food, medical supplies, and materials for shelters have entered Gaza since the start of the Hamas-Israel war. About 100 of them are passing through this crossing point at Nitzana between Israel and Egypt. Here they are scanned for anything that could be smuggled into the Gaza Strip. The trucks with Egyptian license plates start arriving at Nitzana at 8 a.m. Each truck with its loaded pallets is inspected separately, with dogs sniffing for explosives. 2 to 3 hours later, a convoy of 20 to 30 trucks makes its way along the Egyptian side of the border to the Rafah crossing into Gaza, monitored along the way by the Israel Defense Forces. The IDF's Colonel Moshe Tetro, head of the Coordination and Liaison Administration for Gaza, calls the displaced Palestinian condition in Gaza a humanitarian challenge rather than a crisis.
We know that the civil situation in the Gaza Strip is not an easy one. We know that there are a lot of challenges. We know that there are a lot of difficulties. But I can say that there is no humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. We are in war. We didn't pick up this war. Hamas chose to open this war.
Tetro says to accommodate the number of trucks, Israel has had to more than double the security inspection capabilities at the Nitzana crossing.
We are coordinating. Even today, we are coordinating medical supplies to hospitals, together with the ICRC and other international organizations. We are coordinating the evacuation of wounded to Egypt. Basically, every day. The only days that there is no such kind of coordination is when Hamas stops it. Not because the Israeli side.
Tetro says the humanitarian aid will continue as long as it is not diverted for military purposes. He also rejected criticism of Israel's refusal to allow any fuel into Gaza, saying there is plenty there if Hamas would let it be used to help the public instead of its fighters.
We know how much fuel entered Gaza before the war. And when someone says that there is not enough fuel, I think that the most important question that we should ask him, so why you are taking this fuel to the terror tunnels underneath the Gaza city in order that the terrorists will breathe and that they will have light?
In Rafah, the UN refugee agency serving Palestinians, known as UNRWA, has taken over humanitarian aid distribution, moving the loads to different vehicles. Before the war, many trucks went directly from Israel to Gaza through the Kerem Shalom crossing. These days, both Kerem Shalom and the pedestrian Erez crossing are closed. Tetro says that he lost 3 of his soldiers in a Hamas attack against Erez, and that he doesn't know of many countries that would do what Israel is doing, providing safe passage for humanitarian aid to the adversary's civilian population during wartime. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Nitzana Crossing, Israel.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A look at rising global temperatures, why they're rising, and who's being affected by them coming up in a few minutes. Now, we turn to Kyiv and another of the global crises we're keeping an eye on. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine started more than 20 months ago. Since then, Ukrainian forces have surprised the world by fending off one of the world's largest armies. More recently, however, Ukrainian forces have slowed in their counteroffensive, with some in Washington, including Senator Rand Paul, saying the war has become a stalemate and that American money can be better spent elsewhere.
But we're borrowing the money. It doesn't make any sense. It's coming from somewhere where it would be in a productive use to where it's into the use of basically fomenting a war and continuing a war.
So, is the war in Ukraine, in fact, a stalemate? For a look at the military situation in Ukraine, I'm joined by Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
The situation at the front line in Ukraine definitely is quite tough and it's extremely difficult in some points especially. And we can see from the recent statements by the Ukrainian head of the army, and President Zelensky made also certain comments about how difficult the situation is. And we can see that this looks that neither Ukrainian nor Russian forces can show really, you know, a big advance or huge success in any of the areas. However, we are hearing here in Ukraine from the military, and unfortunately we cannot verify this information independently at this point, but it looks like realistic, you know, also realistic picture, if we look generally at the front line, that Ukrainian forces have some minor success in the area of Kherson region and in the area of Avdiivka. And from what military is saying, that Avdiivka, the defense of Avdiivka remains strong, and this is kind of success. If we talk about Kherson region, it looks like Ukrainian forces managed to cross the river of Dnipro. At this point, if this information would be confirmed in some time soon, this would mean that actually there is a chance for some further deoccupation, liberation of certain areas, particularly in the Zaporizhia and Kherson regions.
Some of the strongest pushes from Ukrainian forces have been in the Crimea region. How are things there?
Yeah, actually, Crimea, and actually we have another extremely important direction to look at is Crimea direction. And recently, Oleksiy Danilov, the Secretary of the National Security and Defense Council of Ukraine, stated that Ukraine actually has some good success in the Crimea direction. And he mentioned that mostly what usually we are looking at is success on the land, but he's saying that we should also pay attention to success in the sea. And he is saying that Ukraine had some really successful operations on the sea, with which resulted in actually enabling Russian Federation fleet to to remain in such close line to the front line, and even some of the boats from the Russian fleet had to actually move away, further away, deep into Russian territory. So, according to Mr. Danilov, some more success will be reported soon. And actually, with the recent report from over the night attack that Ukrainian forces confirmed, that Ukrainian intelligence confirmed was implemented in Crimea, it was reported that explosions were heard in the area of Feodosia and near the oil depot. After this report, Ukrainian intelligence confirmed that Ukrainian forces managed to destroy two Russian amphibious boats, which considered modern and extremely quick on the water. These boats were previously used for the occupation of Zmiini Island by Russian forces to transfer military equipment and manpower personnel. And also Ukrainian intelligence provided video of this operation. And this is not the first operation that we've heard about, and that was confirmed actually by Ukrainian forces in this recent time, and particularly in this recent week.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And finally today, another crisis of global significance is the climate. The last 12 months were the hottest Earth has ever recorded, according to a new peer-reviewed report by Climate Central. They're a nonprofit science research group. VOA's Lori London spoke with Peter Girard, their vice president of communications.
The 12-month span between November of 2022 and October of 2023, so the last 12 months that just ended, were the hottest in modern history. So it means that we are approximately 1.3 degrees above pre-industrial levels, so our planet is warmed by that much. And this is a record that has stood for something like 125,000 years.
And we're still burning fossil fuels. It seems like the numbers are going in the wrong direction.
That's exactly right. And we've used attribution analysis to identify what the influence of climate change of those fossil fuels are on the heat that we're seeing across the world. And in many places, we've got clear identification of the fingerprints of climate change, of the influence of carbon pollution on the heat that we felt during 2023.
Given the state of the world right now and the lack of meaningful action to really turn things around, are you expecting your next 12-month record to be worse?
Yes. The next 12 months, these records will continue to fall, and 2024 is widely expected to set a new calendar year record for global heat. So as long as we continue to release carbon pollution at the rate that we've been releasing it, global temperatures will continue to rise, and all of the impacts of climate change will continue to get worse.
Is there any message that you want the world leaders to take from this? We're coming up on the global climate conference in a couple of weeks. What is the message for them?
This is the rare global problem that we actually know how to solve. We have the technology. If we have the political will, we could cut emissions and we could reduce carbon pollution and we could stop this warming in a relatively short span. The planet's temperature will stop rising when we stop adding to this blanket of carbon pollution that's trapping heat on our surface. So we have the solution within reach. We just need the global initiative and the agreement and cooperation to do it.
If that were to take place, if all of those things lined up, it would stay where it is, right? We would still be in a situation where we can expect extreme weather and extreme heat.
That's right. When pollution stops, when we reach this net zero point where we're not emitting any more than we're taking out of the atmosphere, we stop warming, but the effects you see, the temperatures you see, would still be present. However, when you get to a point where you're not polluting, when you hit that net zero point, you can start working on ways to take carbon out of the atmosphere, and that would actually begin to cool down the Earth.
But as you said, you expect the record to continue to fall next year and potentially beyond. Is there time to resolve this realistically, given what it would take for action versus the rapid pace of warming?
In the near term, there is nothing we can do to keep the next few months and possibly even few years from continuing to warm. But there is absolutely time to take these initiatives to reduce the pollution that we're emitting, to slow the rate of warming and to prevent the suffering that's associated with it. And the truth is, there will always be time to avoid some of the worst impacts of climate change. But the longer we wait, the more those impacts will take hold and the more suffering we'll see.
And as you mentioned, suffering, did your analysis address how many people in the world are suffering because of this heat or have been?
We did. And the numbers are staggering. So in terms of the people who in this 12-month record period experienced above average temperatures, it's 99% of humanity. It is just about everyone on the planet. And in terms of the people who have experienced climate change influenced heat at extreme levels at 30-day spans, it's nearly three quarters of everyone on Earth. It's 5.7 billion people. There are entire regions where 100% of the population has been exposed to extreme heat at levels that are dangerous to human health. So this is absolutely a humanitarian problem, and the suffering that we imagine we're going to see in the future, we're seeing it already in the present.
That's VOA's Lori London speaking with Peter Girard of Climate Central. And that's going to end today's program. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.